Hi, this is Craig Ballantyne, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show.
All right, Jason Capital, my man, welcome to the show.
Hey, man, glad to be here.
This is going to be a lot of fun. So I believe we're going on like 12 years of knowing each other. So you want to give people the backstory on how we met when I think you were 19?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm 33 now. So if I was 19, dude, that would
be... But I think it was 2009.
It was 9. So it's like 13, but somewhere between 13 okay. and 14.
Yeah, I forgot what year it was, I guess.
Whatever. That's a long time. If our relationship was a child, it would be getting bar mitzvah this year.
There you go, man.
Yeah, man. So I was just a student at Michigan State University. I played college basketball at a different school, had stopped playing, was just going to school, didn't want a normal job, didn't know what to do. Heard about this seminar called the Underground Online Seminar in Washington, D.C. for internet marketers. And I had like set my eyes and like, I'm going to figure out how to make money with a website. That's what I want to do. So I got to go to this event. It was $3,500 a ticket. I certainly, you know, I had $200 or something to my name. They had a scholarship that they gave away to 10 young entrepreneurs. I applied. I actually wasn't one of the 10. I was number 11. But number 10 was a girl from Pakistan, couldn't get into the US. They called me. They go, "You're 11, but she can't come. Do you want to take the 10th spot?" And I was like, "Absolutely." So
Do you remember how you heard about this thing in the first place?
Ryan,
were you on a bunch of email lists or something?
Ryan McGinn forwarded me an email from, I'm going to pull out a name here, Jim LaBeatty.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing that you knew Ryan all the way back then too.
I had met Ryan 6 months before that. Yeah. And I met him.
Very cool.
It was him and Elliot Holtz. Cause I was playing basketball in St. Petersburg, Florida, and Elliot's gym was right there.
Oh, got it. Okay.
And ironically, dude, I would go to Elliot's gym and he'd have physical newsletters of Dan Kennedy and OSP at the gym.
Yeah. That's right, man. I started writing that thing in 2007 or 8.
With the Superman logo, I remember.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
It's great. So I go to the seminar and the first speaker was Mike Geary. And I just remember he was talking about SEO for Truth About Abs. And I'm sitting there trying to take notes. And within 5 minutes, I stopped taking notes. I'm like, I have no freaking idea what this person is talking about. I am so overwhelmed. And a few hours later, they did a lunch with like the Mastermind members and the scholarship winners. And I knew who you were. So I was like, I'm going to try and sit near Craig. So maybe like we can start talking in some way. And I remember I sat down and I was sitting next to Bill Glazer, which is Dan Kennedy's business partner at the time.
Yeah.
You. And we just started talking. And you ended up pulling me aside. And we sat down on a couch for like 30 or 40 minutes. And you wrote some stuff on a napkin for me. Where you're like, here's how you're going to make money. And I remember that when we were talking, my mom called me and I picked up the phone and I was like, "Mom, I can't talk now. I'm right now. All right. I got to go." But I took that plan. I went back to Michigan State. I did exactly what you said, ended up making really good money really quickly. And literally my whole life was changed because of that interaction with you.
Man, that's amazing. Well, I got, one question as I was putting together a list of questions for this was, were you always this way? Because I don't know if I've met your brother and your sister, but I know that your brother and your sister are, a little more quote unquote, normal, kind of have that more normal lifestyle. And mm-hmm. So were you always this way as a kid?
When you say this way, like, what do you mean?
Yeah. I mean, like you think different. You definitely push yourself to a higher level. And I think that was pretty true of your basketball ways. And maybe after basketball, you just needed another place to channel that energy. Did you always want to get rich when you were a kid? Did you, did you want to, I wouldn't say like, did you want to be famous, but did you want to like lead a movement? Or like what kind of things did you want to be when you were a kid? And so were you always kind of this high charged, ambitious type person?
So it's a great question, man. I was, but I was not like the person I am now. I was incredibly shy. I got bullied a ton from the time I went to middle school and up. And so, you know, like kids would beat me up on the bus, or I remember I met this girl, Ashley, and she liked me. And then the next day the bully found out and beat me up in front of her, you know, like shit like that. And so I just hated people, you know, at 13 years old, I was like, I hate everyone because they hate me. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to get back at them by becoming a big famous basketball player, you know, and that'll really show them. And so the energy was there. And I just channeled it towards basketball, and basketball was safe for me because I could be in a gym all day and not be bullied or not have people talk to me. I could just be alone with the ball and practice. And I got really good at that. And so, when I stopped playing, I had these habits of like, I pick something, I become obsessed with it, and I do everything I can to be the best in the world at it. So that was ingrained just from my teenage years. And I applied it to you know, copywriting and making money and things like that after. But I was never like, I have to be rich. That was never a big thing for me. It was more that I don't want to be normal. That was like my real drive, was I just don't want to be like everybody else. I need to carve out my own path.
Yeah, got it. And then, so before we started recording, you said that you're really in a creative phase right now, and you really like that alone time. So walk me through what you do in your creative phase and how, you know, how you apply your energy, where you apply your energy to, and even like, what do you do to foster that creativity?
Yeah, man. So I have about 100 more pieces of paper that look like this. I think you can see. I don't know if people at home are going to be able to see this stuff here.
Yeah, we're going to put it on YouTube.
Okay, awesome. So this is just someone else's sales letter. And what I do is when I'm being really creative, it's weird, but I spend 2/3 of my time researching rather than expressing or creating stuff. And what I'm doing is I'm just devouring every VSL, webinar, piece of copy, new, old that I can that I think is good for the niches that I'm going into. And my copywriting, my research process is pretty simple. I basically, I don't know if you can see here, right there, it says promise, problem, mechanism, proof, and story. So it's those five words right there. They each get a color. And then as I go through the letter, anything that's a problem gets that color. Anything that's a promise gets that color. Anything that's proof gets yellow, and so on and so forth.
Well, let me ask you this. Yes. Do you read it? I know you probably read it more than once, but do you read it once with the pink highlighter looking for that and then read it again with the blue, or are you just like picking up different colors throughout?
It used to be the first one. Now it's the second one. Now I can, it happens very quickly. Yeah.
Got it. You're like, Edward, do you have them like glued on like Edward Scissorhands? And like-
That's a great question. I keep the caps off and I keep them right next to me. And I usually have two in my hands as I'm like doing this stuff here.
Got it.
But what I found is, It's like being able to put on X-ray goggles when you look at a sales letter and it looks different to you than it looks to everybody else. So for instance, a couple of weeks ago, I wrote a VSL for a skin lifting product. So basically to reverse the appearance of aging skin for women. And so I went through like 7 controls that I thought were amazing in that niche. A couple of them were old ones from Gene Schwartz, some new ones from Golden Hippo, but I'm just like going through them all and I'm doing this process here. Then what I do is I take the best, I like the way that promise was phrased. I like that proof element right there. And I put them in a bank and a Google Doc. So like all the best promises are here. All the best proof elements are here. And now I feel like I have a full set of oils to paint with. And then I go to work on my stuff. But I can't do that until I've done the research first. If I write copy without doing research, it's awful.
So would you say that you use the approach of if you have to chop down a tree, spend 5 hours sharpening the thing and then an hour, you know, actually swinging the axe?
100%. Yeah.
How long would it take you to write a 30 to 60 minute VSL script with when you actually get down to it?
This last one, it's 33 pages and it took me 2 days, but it took me 5 days of research before that to write the VSL. And those 5 days, this is why I'm saying like I'm living alone. I did nothing for those 5 days except for 14 hours a day, just go through these VSLs and research.
Got it. All right. I mean, that's next level. And that's, you know, goes back, I guess, to that obsession that you had with the basketball. And it's like, got to find something else.
Well, you know,
the mentality, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, when I like sit down and reflect on like, what do I actually enjoy doing? What do I enjoy doing with my time? There's not that many things. There's only a few things. It's like, I enjoy working out. I enjoy reading And I enjoy researching and creating things that will make me money or persuade people. That's basically it. So I was like, I just want to cultivate my life in such a way that that's what I'm spending all of my time doing.
So last year you and I had dinner in Miami and I just randomly asked you this question. I said, who's the person that I'm not studying that I should be studying? And you said Alex Hormozi, and that was right before his book came out. And since then, I used to never watch, like I hated watching videos. I hated watching YouTube videos. I hated watching course videos. Even if I spent $2,000 on a course, I hated watching videos. I've actually started watching his videos. And I watch one every single day. But I think one of the reasons why I like watching his stuff is the same reason why I like, you know, having these conversations with you, is because when I watch his stuff, I can tell that he's obsessed with the thing that I'm learning from him in a way that I would never be obsessed with. And it just seems like you have that level of obsession. So is it always that you had this level, like when, as soon as you found out about copywriting and marketing, what was it that you just loved so much about it?
It sounds weird, man, but when I was younger, I was so naive and gullible and so easily taken advantage of by girls or by friends that when I learned copy and realized there's this power for the first time, I was like, oh, I can know all their tricks. I can know all the things that they're using against me. And I think that's where the initial motivation started, because it was like, I've been taken advantage of my whole life. Now I can finally take advantage of other people. And that's not what I do now, but that certainly was a part of it at the beginning.
So it's kind of like your hero's journey evolution, where it's like you got this power and then you used, like you were like almost put in this situation where like I can use it for this or I can use it for good sort of thing. And then you've kind of honed that superpower over the years.
Yeah. I mean, that's at this point though, I like, dude, I look at copy the way I assume, a painter looks at art or something like that. Like in my dream house, like the final home, let's call it, I imagine instead of having a Picasso hanging, I have a Claude Hopkins hanging or a David Ogilvy. Like they're not even them, but they're sales letters. Like it's art to me. The just words, you know, persuasive words and put together is just, it's art to me. And I will say that, just to go back to what you were saying, like, the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years or whatever, we're doing a lot of stuff on Instagram and things like that. I was internally pretty freaking unhappy with my life because I had a whole team and I had all these people who were, for the first time, I wasn't the one selling. I had replaced myself. I'd moved up and now I have other people doing my selling for me. And I felt like I had no purpose and I had nothing to do. And I'm just like sitting there counting cash, which is great, but like, what the hell am I doing with my life? And so I'm actually much happier now because I get to have this obsessive component where I am Mamba in the room. I'm a robot in the room by myself, just studying and creating stuff.
But you're looking at it like art. And so if I can compare myself to you, which is not necessarily fair to you and your copywriting skills, but I don't write copy like you do, but I write a weekly newsletter to my coaching clients. And I look at that thing as like art. Now, the thing that sucks is being, and same with my books too. Like, I feel like those are art projects. The problem is that artists get to stand in front of, you know, an easel and paint, and people are like, oh yeah, okay, that guy's creating art. I'm sitting behind a computer and people think like I'm just screwing around on a computer. So it's the only thing I don't like about my art form is it just looks like I'm a laptop warrior or whatever. Right. But I totally agree that the words that you and I put on paper, I feel the same way that you do. Like your art is a little bit different than mine, but I absolutely love it. Like when I'm done one of those OSP newsletters, which I've been writing every single month for 15 years, like the reason I don't keep doing it for money, because I actually we don't make that much money from that thing, but I just love doing it. I love when it's done. When it's done, and yeah, you know what, there's probably some mistakes in it, but I just get such a sense of accomplishment and a sense of internal reward that's not monetarily based, because I've created something. And I guess that's probably the way you feel about the stuff that you do too.
That's exactly how I feel. It's just fun. And yeah, it's what's cool about it though, is like the artist, like for our art that we create, at least if we're talking about copy, is there's an objective measure for it. Like I know if it's good based on how the market responds. If they pull out their credit cards, it's good. And if they click out, then it's bad. So, you know, whereas if you're an artist and you make something, some people like, some people don't, most of them don't understand it anyways. But for me, it's like, I get immediate feedback and that I'm kind of addicted to also.
Yeah. So I guess that's like where this has also become your basketball, because basketball, they keep score. And like you said, this is actually copywriting is, and I've never actually thought of it that way, but it's actually an objective form of art because you can measure its success.
Exactly.
So yes. You've sold nearly $100 million worth of stuff online, you know, give or take. What have been the biggest lessons that you have learned from that? Like huge, like not a huge list of lessons, but like the hugest lessons that you have learned along the way.
That's a great question. I think that picking the right like message to market match and offer, like getting that at the right time is, it can make an idiot look like a genius, you know, or it can make a genius feel like an idiot. Because there's been times where I create a product that I'm super proud of. I think it's amazing. I think the copy is really good. And then no one buys it. And there's been other times where I put out something that's like, I'm like, it's okay, but I'm not that passionate about it. And it just makes a bunch of money. And the difference is that I chose to go fishing where there were a lot more fish the second time than the first time. Like I'll give you an example. A few years ago, I had that program called IG Agent, where I taught people how to basically make money on Instagram. That thing started selling it, you know, the webinar had like a 12% conversion rate on it was a $1,500 product at the time. And every webinar I'd written before that could never beat like 6 or 7% conversion. And it wasn't that the copy was better. It's just that it was a better fit. People were really hot on Instagram at the time. It was untapped. So I think like market selection and timing and things like that can make an enormous difference.
Right. Because you can have like a great idea, but be 3 years too early. And it just doesn't catch on. And then somebody else comes along with a different version of it 18 months later and it takes off because they're, you know, now they're almost on time sort of thing.
Exactly. Right. You want to be like Zuckerberg and not Tom from MySpace. And, exactly. I mean, it's hard to nail. And I'll tell you that the times where I've made the mistake of the wrong time or the wrong market or whatever is when I'm only thinking about myself. I'm like, no, this is the right product. This is the right time. This is what I would do. You know, when it's me. And then you put it out to the market and everyone's like, no one cares. And I think Gary Bensavenga, he tells this great story about Captain John Raid and the fish. Do you know this story?
No.
So Captain John Raid.
Maybe, unless he's got different names for people in the story, but I don't
Craig, think so. You've been doing this a long time. You've heard a lot of stories. So it's possible you've heard this one.
I've heard every Dan Kennedy story. So if this is a Dan Kennedy story told by a different person, I know it. If it's not, then I might not know it.
I don't think it's a Kennedy story. Captain John Raid is this legendary fisherman outside of Long Island. And he's won awards. And just to give you context, like on Saturdays, they might take like 30 amateur fishers out on one boat and they will catch less fish, all 30 combined, than he will by himself on a single line. He's got all the awards, the trophies, he makes the most money. And everyone's like, how are you such a good fisherman? They actually did a story in the newspaper and TV about him. And he said, because I think like a fish and not the fisherman. Meaning those 30 guys, when they go out on the boat, before they go on the boat, they go to the fishing store and they go, what are all the coolest gadgets you have? And they want to see all the latest stuff. And he goes, that's thinking like a fisherman. Fish don't give a fuck what your line looks like. They don't care. He goes, I go to the water and I just study the fish. Where do they swim? When the wind is blowing that way, where do they go? At this time of day, where are they? And I study their whole environment and it makes it really easy for me to catch as many fish as I want. And marketers a lot of times think like fishermen instead of fish, whether it's with their copy or with their offer. And if we can just think more like the fish, we make a lot more money.
So how do you think like a fish when it comes, you know, to use that analogy, when it comes to putting together new offers, like in this day and age with the way the world is, you know, people are working from home, their, you know, health and fitness is going through the roof. The baby boomer market has a lot of money, you know, those types of things, which are obvious. How do you you know, with all the opportunities, because that's the thing, is you could almost go into any opportunity because of your skill set and do pretty well. But how do you decide which opportunity is really, really worth your time and your skill set?
It's a great question. So I look at a few things. One, I'm looking at where's all the money going? That's the first thing I want to know. Like, who's making the most money right now? And I used to do this when I was younger. I don't know if you did, Craig, where I'd find out someone was making a lot of money, and then instead of learning from them, I would get jealous, or I would judge them, or I would write off their accomplishment for some, you know, some reason to make myself feel better.
Right. They're successful because of this other thing.
Yeah. They're just really good at traffic or whatever nonsense we say.
Right.
I don't do that anymore.
They're probably doing something shady.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my products are good. They sell crap. That's what it is.
Yeah.
I don't do any of that stuff anymore. I just go, all right, so they're making the most money. Let me just study what the hell that they're doing, because, and I have no ego about it. So that's the first thing I do. And, you know, you can look at, there's lots of spy tools on the internet to see where a lot of traffic is going. But I also just talk to a lot of people. I like to ask the king of email marketing, Mike Geary, like, what's making the most money. That's a really helpful insight to find out.
It's funny how Mike is a good friend of yours now compared to a guy who was speaking gobbledygook nonsense to you when you were 19 years old, yeah. Right?
And also, if I asked him about SEO now, he'd be like, who cares how things change? So I talk to people. I just want to see what's making money. So I like reaching my network and I'm like, what's selling? What's hot for you? You know, I want to know what affiliate offers are working for you. Like, those are really useful pieces of information for me. Beyond that, I study the shit out of Reddit. I think Reddit is the greatest place for studying our prospects and seeing what they're talking about. That's really helpful. And then the last thing which I have done, I didn't do it on this last offer, I probably should have, is my friend Caleb. He has this amazing Gary Halbert story where he, in his early 20s, he went and lived on Gary Halbert's couch, and he wanted to be a copywriter. And he paid Gary all the money he had to live on his couch and learn from under him. And so the first day he's there, he's never written copy. Gary goes, we have this client, they sell dick pills, and you're going to write the sales letter for it. And Caleb's like, I'm a 24-year-old male. The hell do I know about selling this product? Like, I don't know how to write copy. Gary's like, no, you're going to do it. Like, if you were writing it, like, what's the headline? Like, what do you think you would say? And Caleb's like, I don't know, probably like, you're going to be this rock star stallion for your wife, right? And Gary's like, you're an idiot. He's like, why? He's like, you just made the number one mistake people make in marketing. You assumed you knew what the prospect wanted. Here's what I want you to do. Here's a list of 200 customer names of people who have previously purchased this product. You're going to call them and you're going to review each and every one of them. And then you will write your sales letter after you've spoken to them. So Caleb spends 2 weeks calling 200 penis pill customers. And he finds out that they weren't buying it to be a rock star for their wife. They were guys who were 70 and 80 years old who felt guilty for not being sexually attracted to their wife of 40 or 50 years anymore. And they thought this would make them feel attracted to her again. And that's why they were buying the product. And that's what he wrote the sales letter about. And the thing was it was the top selling penis pill product that year and his very first sales letter of all time. And that is how you study the fish.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
First of all, it's fascinating that he got even one of those people to answer questions. But I guess if the product helped them, they were probably happy to give some information back. So, yeah. so you've thrown some interesting names around us, and I'm going to ask you about some of your influences in a second. But one of the things that I admire about you that I've watched over your career is that, unlike most people, you are very willing to kill a project quickly, even if you spent a bunch of time, putting time into it, either killing a project that's past its due date and you've got the most from it, or one that you put a lot of work into that didn't work as well as you thought. And most people, they would, you know, continue to put good money into bad, sort of thing, to say it that way, but you don't. Why is it that you operate that way?
Intellectually, obviously we all know about a sunk cost fallacy. And I try to be aware of not being a victim of that. I'm also hyper aware of opportunity cost. You know, if this thing isn't working and my time is going here, are there better places I can allocate this? Like, for instance, right now, this condo here in Puerto Rico, has gone up three times in the last year, its value. So it's like a $13.5 million condo now, right? And Natalie was asking me recently, she was like, you know, maybe you should sell it and get the cash out, right? And I was like, I would only sell it if I felt I could allocate that capital to a place where I could get a better return rather than it just sitting in this place, right? And so I'm always just thinking about, could I get a better return here or a better return there? And if it's not working, then, you know, why would I keep it? But I think the biggest thing, dude, is just, I've worked really hard to have a mentality of like, people have that saying, like, is the juice worth the squeeze, right? Sure. To me, the squeeze is the juice, you know, like the act of creating the thing, that's where all the juice was anyways. It's not going to come from the financial monetary rewards or outcomes that come later. It's, I did it to the best of my ability. I can be proud of myself. I probably learned some things. I've already won. If it doesn't work, I'll just cut it. I don't care. But it's already over at that point once I've created it. Does that make sense?
Totally. Okay. Totally. You know, going back to something that you said earlier, you had, you know, you last year, the couple of years before it, you had all these people working for you, doing some of the stuff that you love, and you know, along the way you had become a leader and grow these teams. From leadership, what did you love about it? What did you loathe about it? And what did you learn from it?
Good questions. So what did I love about having that team? I really enjoyed watching the light bulbs go on in their brains when they learn, when an epiphany moment hits, or they're like, you know, something works that they did and now they feel a little more confident than they did before. And seeing them evolve was very rewarding for me. I enjoyed that part of the process. That was one of the only parts of the process I enjoyed. What did I loathe about it? Most of it, to be honest. The last 5 years just taught me, dude, like I don't have the factory installed parts to have a big team, to have a bunch of people under me. I don't enjoy it. It's not what I want. Maybe one day in the right company, if I had the right partner who handles all of the operations completely, so I can just be a creative, then maybe that could work. But otherwise, I don't see myself going back into it again. I didn't like, at first it was delegating responsibility and outcomes to people that I didn't like, you know, cause you're like, well, they're not going to do as well as me. And so I want to do it myself. There's that whole thing. I got over that. But once they were doing it, you know, I'm always sitting there wondering, is it going to get done on time? Is it going to get done, you know, to a high level? Are they going to forget about this, this, and this? Because I was always aware of that. And you can set up all the Google Sheets and accountability stuff and centralize all the response. It doesn't matter. I still go to sleep with the low level, you know, anxiety as a result of all these people. So I didn't like that. And then the weirdest thing, it sounds weird, but like, I never felt, I never felt free. I felt somehow obligated or in a form of servitude to the team and to the company. And I know there's this whole idea of like service leadership and that kind of thing. That's just not who I am, man. Like, I am a hardcore, like, self-interest type of person. And I think everyone should be. And it just, something about it just didn't vibe with me.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You did cultivate an incredible following as a leader for, you know, the high status summit and that sort of thing. What did you love and loathe about the in-person live event days that you had?
So here's what I didn't like. I didn't like the fact that for an entire week, everyone on my team would not be doing what they normally do, but we'd be working on the event. So you do this whole event, and then there's a lot of payments and onboarding and stuff you have to process after the event. So that's another week right there. And then everyone can finally get back to business. And now we're 2 weeks behind, but we haven't had a 2 week break. And so that would like cost us, you know, a couple of weeks to a month every year. So I wasn't a huge fan of that. What I did like, the other thing, which is going to sound weird, but I always had this fear of getting sick right before the event. And that always scared the shit out of me. Cause like, you know, you wait all year for this event. What if you catch the flu the day before? I don't want that. So that's what I didn't like. What I did like was the freaking events, man. They were incredible. The electricity in the room was amazing. Being able to meet people and have them tell you how you've helped them or, you know, it was cool is I would see the same people come back year after year after year. And I could see their growth and evolution between each year. And I got like,
because it was like, sure, it was the same person, but it's not really the same person.
Yeah, it's a better version. It's an upgraded version of who I met last year. And so that was really cool. And then, you know, one year we had Dan Pena come to the event, and that was something that pissed me off about every event I've ever held. And maybe you've had this experience too, is you get all these people to the event and then they're kind of laissez-faire about being in the room. You know, like you might get 60 or 70% of them sitting in the seats, and the other 20, 30%, they're hanging out in the hallway or they're, you know, whatever. And it just, that always just irritated me, even though when I go to events, I'm the guy in the hallway, but I'm going to be a hypocrite here. But when Dan Pena was on stage, we had, I think, 850 people that year, and there was not a single person in the hallway. Every single soul found a seat for 2.5 hours to listen to that guy talk. And I thought that was, that was a moment that's burned into my brain.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, you and I were talking about a copywriter that I might be hiring who first came into your world through your dating programs. And then he said he met me at one of your events. And, you know, you've definitely created like a legion of successful young men, which is really, really great. And so, I mean, I know that that's something that's very, very cool from those things. The other thing I'll say is, I would say this every time I spoke at your event, is your event was my favorite event to speak at, because even though there were a few people out in the hallway, the people at your event paid more attention to my presentation and were just more fun to speak to than I would say every other presentation I gave at these events where the people were older. And, you know, it's just something about those young, energetic minds, and or maybe it was just like you made such a big deal out of me and that sort of thing. So I really loved your live events. So that was pretty darn cool. Now let's talk about what's that.
I loved having you at all the events. It was so cool for me to, you know, when I first start, like I'm no one and you helped me. And then 10 years later, I get to have an event with an audience and I get to bring you on stage to speak to them. You know, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's very cool. So back to your biggest influences. You've talked about a lot of names. And so what are your biggest influences for like the different parts of, you know, your business, your career, you know, a little bit of your, you know, personal development sort of thing?
Well, in the beginning, you and Joel, influenced me the most and gave me the blueprint to get started making money online. And that was priceless. After that, I spent a few years with Bedros, you know, getting mentoring from him and learning a lot from Bedros, a ton. And then Taki Moore was a big influence for me a few years ago. I was really good at copy, and I was good at being persuasive because I'm a former pickup artist, but I never learned sales, like how to sell high ticket stuff. And Taki is amazing at it. And so he was really helpful. There's a guy in his group named Kevin Hutto, who unfortunately passed away, but he was brilliant marketer that I learned a lot from. And then my biggest influence is I always come back to the best copywriters. They're the ones I learned the most from. So like Claude Hopkins has a book called Scientific Advertising that I've read maybe 5 times. David Ogilvy used to say that if you haven't read this book 7 times, you're not allowed to write copy for me. That was the rule at Ogilvy and Mather. And so I'm not equipped to write copy for David Ogilvy at this point. I got 2 more readings to go. Yeah. That book though is just, I learn something new every time I read it, and it's 100 years old. So that one. And then the other guy is Joe Sugarman, who is, you know, an interesting character, but his books and his copy are lightning in a bottle, and I've learned a ton from him too.
Yeah. Very good. Very helpful. Names that many people won't recognize if they only pay attention to the people on social media today. Speaking of which, you got kicked off Instagram. I've had a couple of people ask me where you are on Instagram, like as if I'm your keeper of your Instagram. But I remember like when you got kicked off, I believe I was following 7 or 9 people at the time. And then I noticed like, there's somebody missing from my Instagram. What the heck? And then I was like, man, I haven't seen anything from Jason in a while. So what happened there? And then how did you turn this into a good thing?
Yeah, man. First of all, I'm sorry to bring who you're following count down. It's so limited already and it's dwindling.
I know. I actually added a few people recently. So I'm up to 9 or 10.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So we're not lowering the bar though, are we? It's still.
No. I added Hormozy and Ryan Stuman and Gerard Adams. Yeah.
Okay. That's pretty solid. So yeah. December 8th, 2021, I got booted from Instagram. If anyone here is going to get banned in the future, like me and big old Donald Trump, then you should know that you won't get any warning. You won't get any notice. They won't tell you why. They'll just take away your account. And so that's what happened to me. I had 2.6 million followers at the time, a Instagram account that was making, you know, over $500,000 a month, and it gone. I felt very mixed emotions when it happened. I was upset, obviously, because I'm like, wow, this, my education company is at risk because Instagram pays for all these people. Yeah. And on the other hand, I was actually kind of excited because I was like, this might mean I finally get to create the content that I actually want to create, not the content that's going to sell stuff. And that was intriguing to me. It's something I've been thinking about already. And so for about a month, we tried to see if we could find other ways to sell, to salvage that company and keep everyone aboard. We couldn't. And so right before New Year's, we let everybody go. So there was 44 people that we let go. That sucked. It's like Happy New Year. But since then, basically I've retired from teaching other people how to make money online. I have an offer that we put online right now where I'm like basically giving away the farm at a big discount because I'm like, I'm done with this and I'm not going to use this stuff anymore. And so my big thing is
that always, just goes to an email list.
Mm-hmm, email list. I still have TikTok. I have 2.7 million followers on TikTok. I have a YouTube channel. I have other stuff and I'm not going anywhere, but I am done with the make money online market, the biz app market. It's not fulfilling. I'm not into it. Yeah. But I'm a big believer that like we have to make our mistakes profitable in some way. Right? It's like a form of alchemy. And so one way was like, all right, I'm retiring promotion. That'll be a way to make money on this and make this profitable. And then the other way is like, I have all this extra free time now and all this extra headspace. What am I going to do with it? And so I have three companies that I'm launching right now. One is a health supplement company. I was talking a little bit about that. Another one is a crypto offer that I'm working on that'll be launching next month. And then I have a virtual metaverse type thing that it's really hard to explain, but I have a third offer there that we're rolling out as well. So I'm just knee deep in copy creating offers. And what I'm doing is I'm partnering with media buyers. Cause I found like, if I'm this good at copy and marketing, if I can find media buyers who are that level of getting the traffic, then we don't really need anyone else. We can just do everything ourselves. So that's kind of the plan. And as a result of that, I don't have to hire a bunch of people. You know, it can just be me, a media buyer, have some contractors for tech stuff, and we can be good to go.
So you used a phrase there that I think is very important for entrepreneurs of every industry. You said headspace. Most people don't have headspace or calendar space. I actually talk a lot about these in my planning stuff. And what I want to do for people is open. I want there to be white space on their calendar, and I want there to be white space in their brain. And so when you were afforded more headspace, what did that do for your creativity? And what can somebody who's already busy do to make a little bit more headspace for themselves so that they can be more creative?
So about 6 months ago, I very quickly made a CBD offer. I own a bunch of Instagram meme pages. And I was like, maybe I'll create a CBD offer and I'll send the meme traffic to CBD and see if we can sell it. I was doing a million things at the time. So I had about one day to write the letter for that CBD offer. And when we put it out, it totally tanked and no one bought. And I knew if I had time, I could have made it work, but I don't have time or the headspace. So that's it. Fast forward to the last couple months when I had all this extra headspace, I wrote a weight loss offer for a weight loss supplement. We're launching in a couple of weeks. So I don't have sales numbers, but I had a couple of who I think are the best copywriters in the world look at it. My friend Ryan Kowalski, who is just a brilliant, brilliant copywriter. I send him the VSL to look at it. And he writes me back and he goes, did you write this? I'm like, yeah. He's like, this is ridiculously good. And I'm like, thanks. And then I showed it to Evaldo Albuquerque, who was the highest grossing copywriter at Agora for the last 4 years, just a brilliant copywriter. And he was like, I have no edits. This is like ridiculously good. And so my point there isn't like, oh, I'm such a good copywriter. It's that when I have headspace, I can create 10 out of 10 shit. And when I don't, my stuff sucks. So like if someone is listening right now and they think their stuff sucks, they should be open to the possibility that it's not that their stuff sucks. They just don't have any headspace, right? And if you have that space, you might be able to create some really, really good stuff.
Let me interrupt there for a second. So, have you ever met Stephen Georgi's wife, Laura?
Yes.
Okay. So yesterday, Laura had me speak to her copywriters. And that was one of the things that I said. My argument was, listen, so I do this little shtick where I get them to figure out what their hourly worth is based on their annual income last year and the assumption that they worked around 2,000 hours in a year, right? Because 50 weeks, 40 hours. And I get them to do that because, you know, they go and they, oh, I mean, I'm charging $15K for a sales letter or $25K. And they inflate their ego. And then when they actually go through and they figure out, well, you know, I probably worked, you know, editing my own videos for my social media and then, you know, running to the UPS store to a FedEx contract, not the FedEx contract, but the UPS contract and so on and so forth. And you get them to see that they probably only spent about 500 to 1,000 hours in a year writing copy. And if I told them that if they get rid of all the $10 an hour tasks and they do nothing, they don't actually get any more copywriting jobs, they'll do better copywriting at the jobs that they do because of exactly what you just described. They'll have more headspace. They won't be rushing through them. And then, you know, if they're getting royalties on it, they'll make way more money by putting better effort into the copywriting, or they'll do such a great job that they'll get way more jobs in the future because, you know, people like me who hire them will say, holy crap, you know, this exceeded my expectations. And I have an influence over a whole bunch of people who ask me for copywriting and I'll be able to tell them about this person, but they won't get that opportunity if they're so busy with $10 an hour tasks that they rush through a sales letter that performs in a mediocre fashion. Yep. And that's what I'm trying to get through to people when it comes to the headspace and how you can do so much better by working less.
Yeah. And I think it just comes down to like having a bias for quality, because so many people have that bias for quantity and, you know, and I've totally done that too. You know, speed is king. Let's get volume. Let's get as much done as we can. It's all about reps. Just keep doing and going. But I would much rather write 3 or 4 kick-ass VSLs in a year than 30 or 40 mediocre ones. And those 3 or 4 that are kick-ass are going to make me significantly more shekels than if I wrote 30 or 40 mediocre ones.
Absolutely. All right, man, I'm going to wrap this up. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate this. I'm going to do a little rapid fire one. I don't normally do this, but there's so many questions I want to ask you, but we'll just get the rapid fire version.
All right, let me get ready for it. Okay.
All right. So just in terms of your routine, of all the biohacking type of things that you've tried, what are the things that you still do?
I do yoga for 30 minutes every morning. I journal every night and I inject myself with vitamins.
Got it. All right. What about the cold plunges and stuff?
I do that every day too.
Yeah, okay, got it. Yeah. Awesome. All right. If you were to recommend one book to somebody who wants to learn how to sell, what book would that be?
Influenced by Cialdini and also Triggers by Joe Sugarman.
Got it. If you were to recommend one book to somebody who was shy or simply underperforming in life and needed personal development, what book would you recommend?
Not to toot my own horn, but I would read my book, Higher Status. Cool. To get that started.
Cool. If you were to recommend one habit for improving someone's personal productivity or discipline, what would that habit be?
I would hire Craig Ballantyne. And if I couldn't do that, I would actually read The Perfect Day Formula and do every single thing that book says.
Amazing. Yeah. If you were to recommend one place in the world that you have been to as the most extraordinary experience, what would you recommend?
So I don't want to give away my treasure, but there is an island called Lanai. It is a private island in Hawaii. There's a Four Seasons on it. There are 3,000 humans on the entire island. It's basically deserted and it's freaking amazing. It's owned by Larry Ellison as well. And that place, I've been a lot of places. That place is special.
Amazing. If there was one, only one of the self-care habits that you do that you could keep, which one would you fight for?
Oh man. It's the cold plunge, dude.
Nice.
Yeah. Do you cold plunge?
I don't regularly, but when we lived in Miami, that gym Anatomy had one that I used every single day. So I would just walk over to the gym to use the cold plunge. But here I've got this little pool back here that's cold, but it's not cold plunge. So I haven't figured it out yet, but it definitely, I do enjoy it. I do enjoy
it. If you want one, there's a hack that I can text you about later, but it basically involves buying a giant freezer and filling it. Yeah, you know about it.
I know of it, but I don't know all the details. So it'll still be helpful.
Okay.
if somebody took away all of your skills except for one, which skill would you want to be left with?
Persuasion. Yeah.
And then I actually forgot to ask you about this, but you said that you got, you know, you set your ego aside. What processes and actions and strategies and tactics did, and therapies and books and all this stuff did you do to help you set your ego aside?
So good question. Set ego aside to me is a misnomer, because I don't think you set it aside. I think you develop a relationship with it. I think the most important relationship you have, the primary relationship, is the one you have with yourself. I think that you cannot give anyone else something that you aren't able to give yourself already, something that you're attuned to doing. So I think developing that relationship with yourself is the most important thing. When I always heard that when I was younger, I go, what the fuck does that mean? That sounds like gobbledygook. And so I've spent, you know, I'm 6 months in working with Brent Charlton, who was originally Neil Strauss's therapist and coach, and he's helped a ton of people. And one of the things he has you do is you develop a relationship with your teen and your child. And these are ego states, but they're a part of you. What you do is you literally close your eyes, you visualize your teenager, or you visualize your child, and you have dialogue and conversations with them. Because what you'll find is when you're triggered, when you're feeling jealous or angry or fearful or shameful or guilty, it's not you, it's your teen or it's your child. And so if you can talk to them about it and you can soothe them, not only does the triggering go down and the present version of you feels better, but every time you talk with them, you're developing a relationship with yourself. That's actually what's happening. And that's the concrete meaning of that term of, you know, self-love or self-care or whatever.
Fascinating, man. Yeah. Okay. Super awesome, dude. All right. Last thing. What are you most excited about these days?
Writing copy, dude.
Boring.
Very, right?
Very good. Wait, so you still do have the YouTube channel?
Yep, sure do.
What is it? YouTube.com/JasonCapital or something else?
Yep, that's it. And I'm actually putting out a new video every day on YouTube now because I have nothing to do on Instagram.
What are the videos about?
They're about everything right now. We're basically throwing a bunch of shit against the wall to see what topics get the most traction. But the, you know, the big ones that, like, I'm basically helping guys find a vision for their life, work on their subcommunications, their persuasion, their relationships, they're making money, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, cool. I'll start checking it up.
Awesome.
Cause you know, I never thought in a million years I'd watch YouTube videos because I'm just such a reader, but finally am. So I'll add you to the list, my man.
You're a YouTuber now, man. You're a convert.
I'm a consumer of the tubes and, but also a producer of the tubes. So thanks, dude. This is good catching up with you, my man. Awesome. Just so proud of you and looking forward to crossing paths again someday soon for another amazing epic meal and so much more.
Dude, I feel the same. Always great hanging out with you. And if anyone is listening right now and you're listening to Craig, you should keep listening to Craig because that's what I do and it makes me money.
Awesome. All right, dude. Thank you so much. Thank you, Jason Capital, for being on the show, and we'll talk to you soon.